Hello and welcome to the very first episode of The Games Press, a monthly podcast series in which I chat to interesting people working in games journalism. My name is Chris Bratt and I'm a part of the team at People Make Games over on YouTube, and I spend quite a lot of time thinking about how we report on and talk about video games because, well, that's the job. And to be totally honest with you, I used to have more people around me to discuss that with, but these days I work from home and I don't know about you, but I haven't been getting out as much lately, you know? And so I've decided to call some folks I know and see if they fancy talking to me about their careers in the games media, and I figured I could probably learn a thing or two from them that might help me with my own work on PMG. My first guest is one of my absolute favourite game critics. His name is Austin Walker, who you might know today as the host of podcasts like Waypoint Radio and Friends at the Table, but he also served as editor-in-chief at Waypoint back when it launched in 2016, and prior to that was a part of Giant Bomb's New York office. He's an incredible writer, and I'm so, so pleased to be kicking the show off with this particular conversation. And yeah, if you enjoy the podcast and want to support us, People Make Games is a Patreon-funded endeavor, and your support allows us to work on projects just like this. Come and join our Discord and tell me who you think I should interview in future episodes. And now, Austin Walker. Hello, Austin. Thank you so much for being the very first guest on the show.
I could not be more honored. Thank you so much for inviting me.
So there's a ton of stuff I'd like to talk to you about today, but I think it might be nice to start at the beginning.
Sure.
Now, if I think I've got this right, you were born in Pennsylvania.
I was born in Pennsylvania.
Grew up in Jersey?
Grew up in Jersey, correct. You were born in Wilkes-Barre, a.k.a. Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Sometimes they say Barry. It's B-A-R-R-E, but locals call it Wilkes-Barre.
Right.
It is the sister city to Scranton, which you might know from The Office, for instance.
Oh,
takes place
okay,
in Scranton.
Right.
So, like, I have family members who, like, work in Scranton and stuff like that.
Nice.
You know?
Okay.
And grew up, but spent most of my childhood in South Jersey, outside of Atlantic City, which is like a gambling town, a shore town, you know, Atlantic City.
So what was your relationship with writing and critical thinking back then? Was there like a young Austin Walker out there somewhere drawing his first comics or writing reviews as a kid? Like,
yeah, yeah. I mean, the answer is yes, right? The answer is that I was grateful enough to have parents who encouraged me to tell stories, to think about the things that excited me, to read comics, to play video games, and to think about them and explain them. You know, like a lot of early memories are like playing word games with my mom. My mom's a poet, right? And so,
right.
And so, like, from my youngest memories, rhyming games and thinking through poetic meanings and like all symbolism, you know, like play in that sense. And then with my dad, similarly, you know, I remember him asking me why I liked the Sega Genesis version of Aladdin more than the Super Nintendo version, right?
Wow. I wasn't expecting there to be something that specific.
Right?
Yeah.
Or you know, the thing I say a lot, the example with my dad is, once I was, like, old enough to have, you know, not adult critical thinking thoughts about movies, but just any sort of, like, this, I liked this or I didn't like this, after every movie we would watch, go to the theater, rent a movie from a rental store, whatever it is, we would take out these yellow legal pads and both write our reviews of the movie down. And, you know, these are like little tiny, you know, two paragraph reviews of just like 10-year-old Austin saying, I liked the acting, I thought this scene was really good or whatever. And obviously that would develop. And by the time I was in high school and we were still doing that, it was like, you know, we were talking about larger themes and stuff like that. And again, like, so both of my parents were huge on that, side of things. And actually both of my parents are divorced and remarried. Always encouraged, always, you know, given that runway to pursue what I loved, because I think they both understood that if you love something, if a child loves something, if a kid loves something, then you can have them, that can be a pivot on which they can develop, right? Whatever that thing is. Like, if I was way into football, they were going to let me go, you know, make sure I got to my football games on time. If I was way into Taekwondo for, like, the years I was doing Taekwondo, like, I was going to be there. They're going to make sure that I had the ability to get the new gi I needed or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, that was, they really, really, really encouraged me as best as they could. Not to say that, like, you know, I was a kid in the world, which means there's troubles, there's struggles, etc. What they never did was, like, tell my mind to take a backseat, you know?
Right.
And I think I had another very familiar thing for a lot of people, which is, like, in grade school and junior high. I don't know what the equivalent is in the UK, but, like, we call high
primary
school.
Primary school, high school.
Primary school, yeah. Until high school, I was, like, straight A student. Like, extremely like top of the class type thing. And then I got to high school and I was like, oh, this is hard. Like I was lucky enough to have a certain intuition about the way school worked as a kid. And then when I got to be in high school and then into college, like I had to start working for it harder and harder or dealing with slightly worse grades. But it was in that period when I also kind of just started doing the thing of like, well, I'm going to really focus on the stuff I like. I'm going to spend a ton of time on this philosophy paper, and then I'm going to skip 15 math classes this year because I just don't care. I just am not moved by this. And that is not a model I suggest other people use. But when I like think of myself at the time, I'm so much of my life has been shaped by enthusiasm to do the things I really like and managing to squeeze by doing that. That does not always mean a great deal of success or a great deal of economic freedom, but it means having it gets me out of bed in the morning. Like as someone who has struggled with depression for most of my life, being able to engage with the stuff that like really makes my brain like tick is the only way that I get through it, you know, especially in a year like this.
Yeah, absolutely. So did you think that would be philosophy for that part of your life? Because I know that's what you ended up studying at college.
Yeah, so I did, you know, I think leaving high school, going into undergrad, I thought I would wind up with an English degree, probably, maybe film studies. I some of the schools I'd applied to and didn't get into had great film programs. And I had, like, you know, toyed with the idea. I never had enough. I had like friends who made movies in high school, you know what I mean? And so like I made some movies with them and like very cheesy, amateurish things, but it was never my beat in that way, but I was interested in it. And I was interested in philosophy because I have an uncle who was, you know, I think at the time he was in his philosophy PhD. And I was just like so impressed by every conversation I was in with him. Do you know what I mean? Just like huge, like inspiration for me, my Uncle Robert. And I was like, when I got to college and kind of came in undecided within the first couple of months of having philosophy courses, I was like, this is it. This hits my brain the right way. I'm interested in these questions. I'm interested in these conversations. I feel challenged in a way that makes me excited. And so, yeah, I think for that period, you know, I actually got into grad school right out of college. I got into City University in New York, where I was going to go study ethics and philosophy. But I was, so at that point, that was the dream, right? That was the like, well, this is obviously the next step. I'm strong in this field. I have, you know, presented at an undergraduate conference, stuff like that, get in. And then the summer before I start, two things happen. One is like the amount of money I will have to take out in loans is substantial, right? Yeah. And terrifying. Two, there's this email thread about all the incoming freshmen, or not freshmen, incoming first years for their master's program, talking about what they've been doing for the last year. And I was just so intimidated. These are people who are like world travelers and people who presented not just at one undergrad conference, but like had won awards for academic papers, who I sounded so much more confident than me in the material. And I like felt like such a poser. I felt like such a fake. And between that and the cost it was going to be, I ended up dropping out before classes even started.
I find that interesting because I spent some of today going through your work up until this point, and part of that was watching a lecture you gave at NYU, in which you're talking in an academic setting, and I find the idea of talking to you kind of intimidating right now for exactly the same reason. So I guess it gives me a little hope.
Please,
that...
I you know, years later would leave academia, and a thing to know is that like my entire time spent in academia was people telling me I didn't have the voice for academia. I didn't have the mastery of the language or my interest.
Who's that coming from?
Professors who had my best interest in heart in terms of getting me past the you know, a thesis defense or a dissertation defense, right? Which is like, you have to work on this because, I mean, the best example of this that was very useful to me, and it was a thing that like stung me when I heard it, and then years later I would be in a situation where I would actually turn it around and give it to somebody else, was like, Austin, I know you love to write the way you write. You like to bring the reader on a journey with you. You're writing this thesis like it's a detective story, that you're working towards some truth. But I don't know where you're going because mm-hmm. you've spent so much time leading me through the twists and turns and not enough time setting up the destination. Like, which is really just a long-winded way of saying, like, work on your intro, make your intro better, give right. the reader a clear idea of what your thesis is and, like, a very clear idea of what the terms are that you're going to be using. And then years later, I was working with a friend of mine when I was at University of Western Ontario, which I'm sure we'll get to. It was a friend of mine, Sam, asked me to read his thesis and give notes. I got, like, 60 pages in, and I had taken all these notes about the things that, like, oh my God, how have you missed this, 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 and this? And he was on music studies, and there was a there was just like this glaring issue in it. And then like page 65, there's this reveal, basically. It's like, oh, this whole thesis pivots on the absence of this thing and then the arrival of this thing. And it's like, well, but for 65 pages, I've been reading this antagonistically. I've been reading mm-hmm. against you here. And if you brought me on board to begin with, I would have. So I was like, Sam, I really love this piece, but you're writing like it's a detective story. And I was like, ah, yes, I understand why this former professor of mine when I was at CalArts had given me the same advice. And so it's funny you say that about the NYU talk, because it's something I've never really felt comfortable with, or I've always felt like I've walked a line between popular criticism and academic interest, if that makes sense. But yeah, so I ended up dropping out of the City University in New York, and then working a bunch of jobs in New York.
Yeah, that's actually, I think I've heard you talk about this a little bit before, but it made for good podcast audio, so I might push you on it slightly. Like, so out of university, you ended up working your first full-time job, not at Giant Bomb or at Waypoint, where people might know you from, but as a trademark researcher.
Trademark researcher. I wouldn't say it was my first full-time job, but it was my first career, I guess. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
I'd worked,
yeah, yeah.
I'd worked retail before that. I'd worked at a supermarket. You know what I mean? Like, I'd done things to make money.
Okay. Well, the first one to make it onto your LinkedIn profile.
There you go. Yeah. Exactly. Is yeah. I was a trademark researcher, which ended up really shaping me also. Trademark research is a weird job, in which you are one of the tiny gears on which all of contemporary capitalism turns. You are the person when a company says, I want to register a trademark for a new product, right? It's mm-hmm. called Splash, and it's a new soda. Now it's your job to go out there and make sure, and this is how they explain the job to you when you first sign up, to go make sure that there isn't another company with another soda called Splash out there that would get us in trouble that would sue us if we release this product.
Is that like a Google search? Like, how you?
It is many. It is a Google search is the last search you do. You start with just searching the trademark database, the registered trademark database,
okay. mm-hmm.
and that is like Boolean searches with lots of character replacements. So if I was searching for, so if someone came to me and said we're doing Splash, I would also look for any other vowel except for I, Splash with a splish, splish with a Y, splosh, right. splush, splotch, any sort of like S, sh, like combination, I would probably need to list, especially if it was a food or drink or a restaurant or anything in the foods and drinks and beverages, sure. alcoholic beverages, anything in those categories. And basically what I often call this reverse data entry, because what you're doing is you're basically building search sets. You're basically building, this is what it was 12 years ago when I was doing it, you're building lines of inquiry to then run and then scanning the data that comes back at you to mark potential risks, sure. right? And again, this is how it was taught to me, and I was terrible at it. The reason I say this yeah. was... Go ahead.
I was gonna say, like, having read, you know, some of your writing and heard you yeah. talk a lot about money, capitalism, your feelings about mm-hmm. large corporations, it doesn't sound like a job you would love. It doesn't
no,
sound like...
but it was a job. I mean, I wasn't as I was left then, mm-hmm. but I wasn't as radical at that point. Nor was I'm not mad at anybody who works as a trademark researcher. You have to make rent. I had applied to dozens of jobs, including some in the games industry. You know, I'd interviewed to work for at the time a large mobile game developer, like six times. I'd gotten deep into a game design test, you know, thing with them. This was, I don't even know if they're around anymore. It was one of the Guillemot family's mobile game things. It was not Ubisoft, but it was like a, right. It was adjacent Game Loft. It was Game Loft. I got six interviews into a Game Loft thing across 4 or 5 months of like, come back in. We're getting down. It's like you or two other people. So you could be speaking to, or I could have burnt out and left the industry entirely, Game Loft's Austin Walker, sure, if things go a little bit differently. So I can't be mad at anybody who takes a job like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I was bad at it. And the thing that hit over time was like, oh, I'm mostly not working in a preventative way. I'm mostly, but mixed in with the preventative, hey, we don't want to step on anyone's toes, is policing the trademark. Is, hey, we made Splash. Is anyone out there trying to do that? Because if they are, they're gonna get a letter from our lawyers, and they're gonna get shut down or get sued. So yeah, I ended up quitting soon after 1UP and EGM closed, or after a lot of people got fired from those places. I think EGM closed, and 1UP stayed on for a little while. But you know, in my heart of hearts, it's like I'd always wanted to be. At this point, I'd given up the philosophy dream, and the backup dream had been games stuff. I'd always loved games. I'd always told myself I didn't want to be in the industry because I was afraid it would, like, ruin some of the sheen and, like, take me away from my love of games.
A fair concern to have, I think.
Yeah, it turns out. but seeing all these people I know whose work I loved lose their jobs all at once made me consider what I was doing with my time. You know, I kept up blogging here and there, tiny blogs that, like, you can't even find anymore. And the idea that, like, oh, I'm never going to write for EGM. I'm never going to get to guest on the 1UP show or GFW radio or be on, you know, whatever, you know, in a video or whatever.
Oh, so it was the idea because they were closing down or people were getting fired. It's like you'd held...
Yeah.
A dream that, like, one day you would...
I would stumble into it, right? Yeah. Why not, right? Like, not a real one, but a sort of fantasy. Do you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, sure.
And not a particularly beautiful fan. I wasn't like, and then my life will be good. But it was like, you know, I'd love to get a review on there one day. That'd be cool. And who knows how things work. These are, especially at this period of time when there weren't conversations yet about parasociality and blah, blah, blah. And so, like, listening to GFW radio at the time was like, oh, these feel like my friends emotionally. I've listened to these people talk for so long. I hear Sean Elliott's voice in my own brain when I'm thinking critically about a game. I hear Jeff Green and Robert Ash. Like, that whole crew was, like, so influential to me as a young kind of game critic. And this is also around the time at which we kind of had the Brainy Sphere and, like, early game blog crit sphere stuff starting up. And so I ended up basically quitting that job. Let's be clear, that job was also just, I wasn't good at it, and I was there until 10 p.m. most nights, and was not able to, like, hang out with friends on a reasonable schedule, and was burning out and having, you know, nightmares about the job, etc. It did completely refine my search skills. I became incredibly good at, like, someone describes a video to me, like, oh, give me 2 minutes, I'll find you that video.
Yeah, like, I hear you do that, actually, mid podcast recording.
Yeah, so that, like, that skill set, I it's nice to have that in some ways. But yeah, so I ended up quitting and then doing some freelance stuff, freelance copywriting basically, and jobs here and there, and, like, started writing for a site that my friends were running called One Last Continue.
Was that just, like, free work at that stage?
Free, you know, we were making making nothing from advertisements. Right. You know what I mean? It was that era of, like, well, we got Google ads hooked into the site, so we get a little bit of something.
Sure.
And that crew was really cool. That crew had, you know, there's a couple people who are still around from that crew at its largest. Sean McIlroy went on to work at Vox and Polygon, I think, in product development, in terms of, like, CMS design and backend web design and stuff like that. Who else? There's somebody else there I know for a fact. I can't think right now, but there were a couple other people who ended up sticking around in the industry over years. And it was, like, fun to have a website that was like, we're trying our best to chase some stuff down here or there. Stephanie Palermo, who is now at Nintendo, I want to say,
right,
briefly wrote for us at One Last Continue.
And it was Austin, like, did you just manage to do one of those very specific Google searches? That's good.
Yes. Like, you could tell, see? Yeah. So the that experience was really cool and was formative at having me work through what it meant to, like, have a content river and think about what a site's voice is, because I started as just a columnist there and then quickly was like the North American editor, which is kind of a BS title for a free site, basically, for a site where everyone's volunteering their time. But it did mean that, like, I was greenlighting pitches and doing close edits and working with people on their voices and all the stuff I would go on to do as an editor in the years to come. And, you know, that was a fun and weird experience. There were, like, a couple of bigger things that I hit at the time. I reported out some stuff on 6 Days in Fallujah, which we're back to today. Yeah, there's some old Kotaku story that's quoting me and my research on, guess what, trademarks and 6 Days in Fallujah.
No way. Oh,
yeah, absolutely.
Great.
Because at the time, you know, that game is still the thing it was in many ways. At the time, they were saying that they'd only recently started development on it because they didn't think it was time to tell that story until blah, blah, blah. But I was like, that doesn't sound legit. And so I dug around the trademark office because all that stuff's open. I didn't have the tool set that I used to have as a professional trademark researcher, but you can still dig into those files. And I found those trademarks registered years previously, like at the, if I remember right, soon after or during the Battle of Fallujah. Like, this was very clearly not, like, what they were saying about being very respectful and distant and tasteful was just not true. So that was a story that I broke at the time that made me feel like, huh, maybe there's something to this. And yeah, so that was like a fun little thing. And then the economy fell apart.
This is the kind of eye-opening part of your story to me, I guess, because today you're such an established, sought-after voice in the games media, and yet you had to try twice to get into the games media. Like,
totally. I stopped at this point. The economy fell apart, which meant I couldn't. I ended up not having, like, income anymore. I couldn't even find a job as, like, a barista. Do you know what I was, like, right, applying for jobs every day, and just nothing was coming back. This was during the recession. So this was like 2009, and I ended up having to move back in with my parents in Jersey, left New York behind, and then very quickly realized that, you know, in those few years I'd spent away, I just couldn't live at home anymore. I needed to, like, control my own time in an adult way, and, like, and also I was just bored to death. Do you know what I mean? And so I ended up working at a comic shop for 6 months, which was fun, a comic and, like, tabletop game store, and then went to CalArts to do a master's, which was stressful because this time I couldn't let myself get intimidated into quitting because I didn't have, like, an apartment near New York to go back to. You know what I mean? I was like, this is my way into whatever the next phase of my life is.
And was that going to be academia then? Was that the plan?
Yeah, more or less, right? It was like academia or LA. I have friends out in LA. CalArts is north of LA by like 40 minutes, give or take. And who knows? Maybe I get into television. Maybe I get into film. Maybe I get into something else. But, like, academia felt like a space I felt comfortable in and confident in. The program was aesthetics and politics. It was weird because CalArts is an art school. At the time, the only non-fine arts degree was aesthetics and politics. So that meant I was surrounded every day by people who were doing, you know, music and painting and conceptual art and sculpture, animation, both kind of mass market Disney-style animation and really cool experimental stuff. I was surrounded by creativity all day for a year, every day for a year. And that was fantastic.
Sounds it.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was also very foundational in terms of just continuing to find my voice and continuing to, like, develop as a thinker or whatever, you know. And at that point, I'd given up. I'd given up on games. Like, I had 100% been like, well, this is what I'm not games and me. Nah, not so much anymore. I guess, though, at the same time, I was starting to talk to people about games on Twitter more. I joined Twitter after the 1UP stuff, and slowly started following people and getting into conversations. But I wasn't, like, writing for the public again yet. and during my master's. And then at the very end of my master's, I did a paper on Flower, Sun, and Rain, the Suda 51 game that had come out on the DS, which I think is like a fantastic game. And I miss that Suda a lot because it's so... It's such a hostile game in so many ways. It's a game about being on an island and trying to find a bomb before it goes off, and it always goes off, and you cycle back around to the start of the day, and things go a little bit differently the next day. And you're just, like, running around and talking to people. It's an adventure game in the sense that, like, you're running around and trying to find the right pixel to click on, basically, and then getting conversations. But just filled with really idiosyncratic characters and a really... just a cool vibe, and writing about that game re-sparked something in me that was like, I could write about games again. Should I get into game studies? Like, I've flirted with game studies here and there, but I haven't really done it. And then I started kind of going down that road and realized that my heart was in two things, video games and Marxism. and I decided I wanted to go to the University of Western Ontario to go work with Nick Dyer-Witherford and some other people there who were in media studies who could help sharpen those tools and work on figuring out if I could make a contribution to that space. And so I left America and moved to Canada for 4 years, give or take. And that was a whole thing. So, and that's when I started blogging again. That's when I started, like, you know, TA money is rough. TA money is not a lot of money. And so it was like, I could, if I start blogging again, and if I can get a little bit of a following, I can start pitching to outlets and supplement my income with a little bit of extra cash. And that's how I started writing about games, like, consistently, both on my own blog, Clockwork Worlds, and then getting picked up by places like Paste.
What kind of things were you pitching at the point?
Big things, big crit pieces. I guess that's not the only thing I was doing at the time. I think the first thing I wrote for Paste was about Indie 3, which was a small, like, counter E3 that some folks in the independent scene, quote unquote, at the time ran. It's so funny to see that and think about that versus something like the Wholesome Direct now.
Yeah.
And at the time, it was an all online event. Maybe there was a local thing happening at whatever Indie 3 was, but it was mostly an online showcase. And I'd be really curious to go back and watch that footage now and contrast it with what has become such a standard model of people talking and then trailers play and then maybe there's like a panel and that's the vibe, because now we're just all that, you know.
Yeah.
And at the time it was a critique of that event, the thing that I ran with. It was me and Cameron writing about that. Cameron Kunzelman and I did a lot of writing together at the time, also an academic, a very close friend and peer of mine. Cam and I wrote about that. We wrote about a few other things. I also worked with Ian Williams, who's another freelancer who I would go on to work with to write about things like the ways in which advertisements to go work at places like Blizzard were kind of anti-worker because of all the family language that was used and all of the, like, this is the best place to work and we have a great cafeteria and coming home, you know.
So much of the work you've referenced so far sounds quite timeless.
It hasn't changed. None of this stuff has changed, right? It's so frustrating in so many ways. With the thing that Ian and I had written about, that we're like, I was like, listen, our understanding is Blizzard pays pretty well and gives pretty good benefits. You're not advertising that. You're advertising all of the things that you need to push your employees into crunch, to leverage their passion and loyalty, instead of, hey, this is a good place to work. And as if you're going to be a standard bearer, actually push the stuff that is about hours, push the stuff that's about good pay, fair pay. Because if you do that, it normalizes it for the entire industry to focus on that. And again, that was a piece I wrote 7 years ago. It's the same conversation today in so many places, right? Which is kind of damning. I was pitching stuff like that, and that stuff was getting picked up. Both of those are Paste things. And then reviews. I started doing reviews for Paste and then for GameSpot. I was working with Kevin Van Ord at GameSpot. I was working with Garrett Martin at Paste, both of whom extremely thankful took a chance on me. I was writing very long pieces, stuff that was, I mean, there's stuff that I've been pitching around for a while that Garrett was willing to take a chance on with me, that I will always be grateful for. Still one of my favorite pieces I've ever written is Real Human Beings, which is about Shadows of Mordor and Watch Dogs. And both of those systems, both of those games had systems about creating procedurally generated people, the orcs in Shadow of Mordor, and then the random civilians in Watch Dogs, is Watch Dogs 1. And that piece, I think, is probably one of the sharp... It's close to the sharpest I think I've ever been in terms of identifying an interesting mechanical through line and then figuring out a way to connect that to cultural, like, concerns and my personal concerns. And that's a piece I pitched around for months and no one wanted it. And, like, I got, like, rude emails and very dismissive, like, you know, kind of like your eyes are bigger than your stomach type things, like, sure. Which I get. Garrett took a chance on it. That piece did pretty well. I was happy with that piece. You know, that's the thing it is. And so, yeah, started doing that. And then academically, I was doing work in the realm of games and labor and thinking about ways in which those two things overlap, types of play that bring the player into the mechanism of the game in order to make the game work. So, like, I was working on a chapter on EVE Online, which is, like, that's a game that only works if people play it, right? The systems obviously are in place, and the servers need to be online, and you need to patch that game, but the players are
the
game, right? Mm-hmm. And so, like, what's that mean in terms of labor? What's that labor relation? A super fascinating game, because through its history, there are moments that if you accept that there is labor happening there, then, which you do if you also accept that value is being produced, then there are ways in which you can look at certain fan movements as being labor movements or labor demands. So things like when EVE launched, there the only time that you could... Have you ever played EVE Online?
No, I'm as with most people, I've spent a lot of time reading about it.
Yeah. Here's a very basic thing. When I was playing EVE Online, maybe this has changed since, because I've not been deep in this community. When I was playing it and researching it, the way it would work is you have a character. Your character has a brain. You slot little USB sticks into your brain in order to learn things. They basically download the skill into your brain from the USB stick. This is, I'm narrativizing here a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And those skill books would take a certain amount of time to get into your brain. They'd start very low at like 20 minutes, but by the big ones, we're talking about 3.5 days, 10 days, et cetera.
Wow, okay.
You could do a bunch of them at once. And when I was playing, you could queue them up. You could be like, well, this book is done. Let's go to this next one. Let's go from, you know, I want to learn how to pilot the ship faster, to this next one, which is about, you know, making my guns shoot faster or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
When the game launched, that didn't exist. When the game launched, you had to be there to switch over from one skill book to the other. And so you'd talk to people who played then, and they were like, yeah, I set alarm at 3 a.m., so I would get up and immediately start that next skill book, because it's such a PvP game that being on the cutting edge of your skills was one small thing that you could shift to give yourself a tiny advantage in a conflict. And so, yeah, people were setting alarms for the middle of the night to wake up and change their skill books over. And one of the things that a group of players first pushed for was skill queuing, so that you didn't have to do that. You know, it's not, you can't queue or you couldn't queue infinite skills, but you could queue a number of them in a row so that you could at least wait until you were awake and set up the next set of the queue. And it's like, wow, that's interesting. If you accept that, then, and there's a bunch of other things, similar quality of life type things, which are quality of life changes, but also if you accept that they are producing value for the company, those can also be looked at sort of soft labor demands, which is really fascinating. And, like, so that's the sort of academic work I was doing at the time. Very not mainstream work, you know?
So as that stuff, I guess particularly the more video game focused aspects, as that stuff is starting to land and, you know, getting published with publications that you care about, with editors that or respecting the work that you're doing, were you just starting to realize that you did want to return to that world? Was that like a gradual process?
It was a gradual process. That's right. I really liked doing that sort of work, and it was a charged time. It was a difficult time. We're talking about 2014. Mm-hmm. We're talking about Gamergate. We're talking about Black Lives Matter. I feel very far away from my home. I'm in Canada. I'm not from Canada. Yeah. I feel like, you know, I had already left New York when Occupy, just before Occupy kicked off. Mm-hmm. And then I left the state. I was away from the States while Black Lives Matter was happening. And so I'd felt very much like, I can't believe I'm not more engaged with this stuff. I can't believe the degree to which I've put myself at remove. And then Gamergate was kind of the opposite, which is like, to the degree that was a big digital conversation, that was a digital conversation, and conversation is a let's be clear. Gamergate was a harassment campaign, mm-hmm. it was a misogynist at its core, et cetera, et cetera. You know where I stand on this.
Yeah.
But I was doing my best to stay engaged digitally there as much as possible and to try to be a voice pushing people to take it seriously and blah, blah, blah. And I didn't know if that was going to be the future because that was burning me out. It was very frustrating to see very basic conversations feel like they were being framed as radical in terms of like what needed to change in this industry and how we got here in the first place. A lot of people acting like this was some, you know, once in a lifetime freak thing, where in fact it was obviously the continuation of entire lines of thought and culture that had been in this industry for decades and had found nourishment and blah, blah, blah. And so I wasn't sure. And in fact, at that point, I was floating kind of three different versions of my future. One was stay in academia forever, continue down this path of writing for a small audience, but getting to write very in-depth work about topics that could never be a really wide audience thing. No one wants... I just gave you like the 5-minute version of that Eve thing, right? Maybe 10 minutes. And it was already skirting on boredom. Not from you, but from some listener out there. Like, this is, what are you talking about? Imagine that for 70 pages. Do you know what I mean? Like, right. That's the sort of work it is. And that's one version of it. One version was game dev. I actually got deep again into a interview process with Gearbox after Borderlands 2. So in retrospect, that project would have probably gone on to be, what was that? Not MOBA. What was their hero game?
Battleborn.
That probably would have been for Battleborn they were hiring up writers for. I did not get that job, but I was, again, I went through that whole process. And then the third one, which was actually in process, the other game dev job that was in process in terms of interviews and stuff was Warframe, because Warframe is in London, Ontario, which is where I was. Yeah. I'm at the University of Western Ontario, and there's like a connection between some folks at that company and the school I was at. And so I'd kind of gone back and forth a few times with them on some potential positions and stuff. And thought about like, hey, maybe I can make something like this work. And even the thing there was like, I could do that and maybe still finish this PhD that I was working on. I'd still be in town, you know, and I could still like maybe it'd come slower, but I'd figure it out. And then I, you know, on a whim kind of emailed or DM'd Alex Navarro at Giant Bomb. And I was like, y'all still haven't filled this position. Is it worth it for me to apply? Am I going to be churning out news stories for you? Or like, and if so, is that going to be boring? and this was soon after Vinny moved to the East Coast, moved back to the East Coast, and they were building their studio and et cetera. And Alex was like, listen, man, you should apply for it. We'll see how it goes. You know, I think you'd have a good time. And so I applied for it. At that point, I feel like I'd been teaching for years. So I had a good, you know, a pleasant teaching voice. I'd done some streaming, and so I could do the sort of like, well, here's what my life story is, and here's why I think it'd be a good fit for Giant Bomb, and da 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 da.
So it is a news editor position, and although like earlier on when you were talking about some of the stories you broke,
I moved out of that space so clearly.
But also, I don't necessarily think of that being the thing that you're most enthusiastic about. Like, it's games criticism. And so, did during those conversations, were you able to like put that forward? Did you worry about losing the
I did worry about that. I'd done a couple of interviews that were strong enough. Like I'd there's an interview out there from me talking to some folks at Twitch from like 2014 about their growth strategy, the ways in which people on Twitch have to stream for too many hours per day in order to like maintain audiences, mm-hmm. How many people were getting cuts of their income, basically. Like, there at that point, it was very hard to become a partner, and right. I think the I believe the associate? Is that the mid-tier?
Affiliate.
Affiliate, thank you. Affiliate didn't exist at that point. There were all these people streaming on Twitch not getting ad revenue, right? And so that was something that was really fascinating for me. So I'd done this interview with the folks at Twitch in which they made some slip-ups, and like there were some very funny, in retrospect, like, I mean, even at the time, it was just one of those things where it's like they did not want to be pushed on what the model really was, how much people had to work to make a living, the degree to which they were encouraging people to overwork themselves, etc. And I think interviews like that helped sell that I could do the news part, because I was, and I was also just ear to ground in a way that was, by ear to ground, what I mean is I was actually just extremely online in the sort of way that meant I'd built a network of people who were willing to tell me some things early or etc. I built basic, some very basic sources, even though I wasn't a news writer at that point. And I think that perspective helped a lot. And then also, they were trying to launch Giant Bomb East, and that meant needing to have someone on a podcast. That meant needing to have another chair in video stuff. And so my experience on that stuff did also lend me to that role. I'd been streaming for a few years with a group called Stream Friends. I'd been very used to doing podcasting, so I was familiar enough and comfortable enough in those other parts of the role that I think I was confident I would make a good fit. I did emphasize that I wanted to do Crit, and like, you know, to their credit, everyone there felt that that was necessary coming out of Gamergate, but also just they felt that that was the way the wind was blowing, that we were not going back to a political games Crit. Like, this was going to be a part of this industry, and that part of the industry should be represented at Giant Bomb, you know. So that felt good. It felt really good, especially as a fan of that site. A fan of that site and someone who had seen them go through stuff previously in terms of new hires, and in terms of political stuff, right? Patrick and I had spoken a couple of times before we knew each other, but I remember watching him, like, just get devoured by the Giant Bomb audience, just get completely heckled because of his, you know, very nascent interest in the sort of like in feminism, very basic stuff. And so to some degree, I was like, I know I'm walking into a contested space, and they knew they needed to be willing to like step up to that and hire someone who would not be afraid to have those conversations. Right. So,
yeah, my first full-time job in the games media also involved joining a kind of personality-led,
right,
video-focused game site on a much, much smaller level than Giant Bomb. But I remember being really overwhelmed back then by that fact. And I think it took me kind of a while to find my own voice within this sort of predefined team. And
was there a thing that made you like find it? Was there like a specific moment, or was it just like erosion? Like every day you're getting shaped a little bit more and more in that direction?
It was actually, so I think when I joined like a two-person video team, but the whole site was involved in video, and the person who was senior to me, who was a brilliant mentor, and was Matt Lees, I don't know if
I've met him.
So he was doing really amazing work at Video Game at the time, and was the big draw to the site from on the video perspective. And I think it was probably him leaving and there not being this huge shadow to work under, which is not his fault, but it was
definitely... No, that happens.
Yeah, it certainly happens. It's a little confusing here because part of that insecurity probably also comes from being like 23 or 24 at the time.
Sure, yeah, but, totally.
But how did you find it joining Giant Bomb, joining a team that it does not just have an audience, it has a fan base, and that fan base is going to expect certain things about what a Giant Bomb voice can be?
It was weird. There's two answers. One is, how did it feel around Alex and Vinny? How did it feel on the calls with the whole team? Great. Always good. Extremely welcoming. Going out to like meet everybody at E3 right after I was hired was incredible. Getting to go, I just did that Beastcast where I went over some of our favorite moments and things like the comedy club stuff at PAX West that in 2016 was really fun. There's like again and again and again, incredibly warm moments with everyone on that team. There are so many mentors I have from that team.
I'm so
lucky for that. From the audience, it was touch and go. Like, there were people who were so excited to have me join, who felt like they were seen for the first time, that they had been quiet and they had felt like they can kind of be wallflowers in the community, but they can't partake. They can't, like, be in the conversation. They don't have anyone who voices their feelings or who has their perspective. And those people let me know. Those people let me know that I meant a lot to them, and I will always be grateful for that. To this day, people message me, and that, even if I don't get back to everybody, it means the world whenever anyone says that. There were also people who were like, well, this is the end of this website, you know? This is the death knell, finally. Why can't people just be goofy and play video games all the time? And it's like, 90% of what I do is be goofy and play video games. Like, it's not the end of the world that I wrote a piece on The Witcher 3 and race or whatever. Do you know what I mean? That didn't ruin the website. It's additive. If you don't like it, you don't have to read it. We're over here playing FMV games later today, too, and it's not like I'm in there, like, doing Marxist critique of the FMV genre, you know what I mean? Or whatever. Like, I'm not, as much as people would say, and people did say that I was, like, shoving politics down their throats. Like, I don't know, you're lining up with a fork and knife. You're ready to go, you know? You're the one who's, like, really eager to get into this argument in this comment section. And so I think I definitely put a lot of people off, and it can be really hard to know the difference, to know what the ratio is. You know, the majority of people are not going to tell you that you're doing a good job, and there will be what feels like an impossibly large group picking over every word you say.
Yeah.
Because they are fans. They are fans in the way that someone who likes the MCU sees the MCU stuff. And, like, the same way that if you're into pro wrestling, you watch wrestling things and talk about when there's someone does a botch, you know, and messes something up. Or if you like sports, when someone makes a good play or makes a bad play or has a bad call or whatever, all of those attitude, all of those behaviors also exist here in the online personality space. So it was tough, but I don't know. I'm grateful to be surrounded by people who, when I needed external validation, were able to give me that.
And what does that look like? Is that you, if something is going on, you say like, hey, I need to talk to you about this? Like,
I think most of the time it's pretty clear when I'm in a bad place. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
With people I worked with, it would be like, hey, did you see this thread? People are mad that I did blank. Or it would be, hey, people will not stop tweeting at me about blank. And, you know, there are different days require different sorts of responses. Some days that response is, do you want to get a drink after work? Do you want to go get dinner? Do you want to go hang out? Do you want to play a game? Do you want to da da da? Other days, it's more specific advice, and it's like, hey, why do you think they're doing this? What's really happening here? And then also sometimes you make real mistakes. You know what I mean? Yeah. I would say I didn't make that many mistakes at Giant Bomb necessarily, because I just wasn't in a position of authority to make those sorts of mistakes. I can think of most of them. I don't know if everyone is like this, but there are mistakes that sit with me that are not, that I know no one else will ever, 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 ever realize was a mistake or care about. Here's one. Ubisoft's 2015 or 2016 presentation at E3. A new trailer hits, and I go, oh, I think this is Anno da-da-da-da-da, whatever Anno game was about to be announced. And Jeff goes, and he does that because Jeff and I both know that this Anno game is about to be announced because of leaks or because of a source.
Okay, yeah.
And it is not a public thing. And right. I go, maybe, I'm not sure. And I try to cover it as soon as I can.
So you, okay, you.
It's been in my brain now for 5 years. Do you know what I mean? Like, a second before it came out, was like, oh yeah, this is that new Anno game.
I think you can let that one go. I think
I can't. It's in there. You know, it's like one of those many things. Mm-hmm. And like, no one cared. Jeff wasn't mad about it. Do you know what I mean? But
yeah.
when I think about the mistakes that keep me up at night are much bigger, are much more like, oh my God, I let down the entire audience and I communicated to someone that their pain isn't real, even though that was not my intention, or I hurt someone through the publishing of this piece, and I don't know that a lot of people earn that trust back. Like, those are the real things, but sure. Even those little things stick with me, and the fact that those little things stick with me is why I'm like not too bent out of shape about the Anno thing, and in general I think I did a pretty good job at Giant Bomb about doing what I was supposed to do there, and was grateful to be part of building something new with people I loved. So
yeah,
people I came to love. I didn't love them. I barely knew them, sure. Right? And then within that year, it was like it really, really, really was a trial by fire situation where like this is going to catalyze something, you know? And for me, what it led to was a deep bond with everyone there. So
yeah, I mean that came through on the final Beastcast episode that you guys recorded, which it seems wild to me that you were only there for a year, because
it's so weird, right? Both
you had a huge impact on the site, and it clearly meant a lot to you.
It's so weird, like, you know, I came through often enough to like have my face in the mix. I think it speaks to how welcoming they always were when I came back for something, and how we never really left each other's orbits, you know. I mm-hmm. talked to most of those guys a few times a week still, you know. And so it never really felt like I was told not to be, you know what I mean? Like I was never not part of a larger breathing thing called mm-hmm. Giant Bomb, even if I was not on content day in and day out, you know? Also there's audience overlap and a bunch of other things, you know, like it's a weird thing, but that proximity means that there's a sense of camaraderie and belonging, even if you're not in the same meetings anymore, you know?
So why did you leave?
Because I had this opportunity to go build Waypoint. I'd gotten a call in. I mean, there's a longer story here, which is one was like, I don't know if Giant Bomb's going to exist in 6 months. At the time, we had just lost. I'd mentioned Stan earlier, who was a business development person, who was sort of one of my many bosses. Like my job at Giant Bomb was very strange because I was on the East Coast. Vinny was sort of my boss because he was kind of the head of the East Coast. If I needed something edited quickly, Alex would edit it because he was editorial East Coast. My technical boss was Jeff because he was the head of editorial at that point, but he was on the West Coast. And then the person who I had the most like performance meetings with was Stan because he was the numbers guy. He was the person who had to make sure that we had growth on the site, right? One of my goals was to get new eyes on the site, not just mm-hmm. through my presence on podcast and video, but as a writer. You know, video isn't searchable by Google. Google can't, if someone searches for Xenoblade Chronicles X boss fight or whatever, they're not going, they might get a YouTube video, but they're not going to get minute 42 of that YouTube video, right? Where that conversation happens. And so part of writing text on a website is Google will see this, search engines will see this, and that will raise our search engine placement, and that will get new eyes on the site. You let us worry about converting the eyes that are already here into subscribers. Austin, you figure out how to get new people here. And so I work with Stan quite a lot in terms of figuring out what sorts of articles I was writing, what the cadence should be, etc. Jeff was also involved in those conversations, to be honest, like to be clear, like Jeff was one of the first people to tell me that as a professional writer, you have to focus on batting average and not home runs.
I think I've heard you maybe talk about that. Perhaps it was on that last podcast.
A thousand times,
I literally was talking to this with Quinn's in relation to like me not feeling very good about a video that had just gone up. I was like, no, you know what? It's batting average.
Batting average. It's not home runs. It's you're going to put out some clunkers. It's going to happen. Mm-hmm. It's going to happen. You have to accept that it's going to happen, and it's okay because it's just not, the model is not perfection. And so Stan left. Stan got fired. I was not in those meetings. What I will say is Stan was an incredible advocate for everyone at Giant Bomb at a company that felt like we were not valued. We're at a company where I felt like we were not valued particularly well by the higher ups. The people at GameSpot loved us. We loved the people at GameSpot. Yeah, you know, 100% co-value there, 100% to be clear. But the higher ups at CBS Interactive at the time felt like we were invisible to. And, you know, I was entry level, whatever. You know what I mean? I was not I'm not in any of those meetings, but it didn't feel stable at that point. And so when Joel Fowler, who was at Vice at the time, reached out to me to be like, hey, I'd love to talk to you about the idea of building something here at Vice, I took that meeting, and then I took more meetings and started sketching out what that would look like. And that was extremely stressful and sad because I could feel like, okay, this is it. I'm going to end up leaving this place that I love, that I love working. And I should be extremely clear, like Jeff fought for me to stay. Jeff, you know, came back and matched the salary that I'd be getting at Vice. Vice was absolutely underpaying me for an editor-in-chief there, like a thousand percent, like way underpaying me compared to other EICs, even at Vice. Jeff managed to still get that. I mean, that was still would have been a big upgrade from where I was at Giant Bomb as an entry-level person. But looking back at that moment now, I didn't have the language to say what I needed to stay a giant bomb, which was to figure out what my place would be in that company long term. If I could go back and tell something to myself, it would be to consider saying, hey, I'd like to be managing editor of Giant Bomb one day. How do I get on that path? How do we start working towards that? Because I want to make sure that the different parts of this company are talking to each other and are organized, and I want to strategize about content, what our content schedule is going to look like for the next year or for the next season. I want to figure out some big tentpole events. I want to, like, those sorts of things were skills that I would come to learn and like to use at Vice, and I didn't know that those were things I wanted to learn
right.
to do yet, so I couldn't even voice that. Because if I could have done that, then maybe there's a world where I stay. But instead, I just felt so unmoored that the opportunity felt so grand. The idea that I would go start something new and get to shape it and theoretically have the backing of this big media company, which was deeply, you know, respected for its style of reporting, where I felt like I'd be able to go even further in terms of the topics I was tackling, and specifically using their money to pay freelancers to write stuff that previously were not getting platformed, right? Or were only getting platformed at places like Paste. That was such a big offer and such a big, opportunity to try to add something to the world of games that it was really hard to say no to. So yeah, that's kind of why I left, but it was extremely sad. You know, I a tearful goodbye to everybody there when I left, incredible words of encouragement from everyone there when I left. I was so grateful that when we did launch Waypoint officially, Vinny, Alex, and Jeff all came on that first day, 'cause that felt like a sort of, kind of like a blessing and a sort of like go with God, and we have your back still, and so like those connections still are with me till this day. It means the world to me that they all supported me as I made that move. Jeff, I went to talk to Jeff Bacalar at the time to be like, am I doing the right thing? And Jeff was like, you were absolutely doing the right thing, dude.
Yep.
And so yeah, everyone there saw me through that change and on top of it made it exciting for everybody. They let me say goodbye to everyone at E3. We continued to make content till the day I left. There were no hard feelings, and like that meant a lot to me at the time.
Eurogamer did something very similar for me when I left, obviously launching something quite similar to what I'd been doing at that site on Patreon. And like on the day that happened, they ran a post on the site promoting that, like they were the first patrons that me and Annie like received.
That's incredible.
And I believe what you say, because I recognize how important something like that can be.
Well, and then the thing is, you get to keep seeing them. Like on the East Coast, I could still go through for fundraiser stuff, or if I was just in the neighborhood or whatever. And then Jeff and I got to bond a lot over the years at Judges Week events.
Oh, yeah, right.
Because I suddenly was a judge, an E3 judge, because of being the EIC at Waypoint. And so it was always nice to go out to LA and like hang out with Jeff for a week and catch up and see games and share feelings about those games and like get that part of hanging out that we ironically never got while I was there because of how busy we were and how he was on the West Coast and I was on the East Coast,
So you were brought in as EIC at Waypoint in launched in 2016, is that right?
2016 is right. Yeah, it's
5 years. I know there'd been a UK games thing with
Mike Diver had been doing Vice Games for years. Yeah,
sure.
Totally.
But this was because of the sheer size of the US launch, it's essentially this fresh slate for you.
It's tough because I want to call it a blank canvas, but I it is so important to me to underscore the work that Mike did, because I mean literally understand that the socials got their names changed. There was a Vice Games Twitter account, there was a Vice Games Facebook account. Mike had already spent years building those up. And I think that Mike's contributions to the foundation of Waypoint have gone deeply understated over the years. Like, again, if I have a mistake, I think about it a lot, and I think that like not doing more to build a bridge from my audience to Mike's audience is a mistake, right? It was tough because we were on different sides of the ocean. His schedule was different than ours on top of that. And we didn't have a studio. Like, we didn't have the stuff that we would, everything was so touch and go at the start of Waypoint in so many ways that it was hard to bring Mike in the way we should have brought Mike in. Mm-hmm. And also there were just different expectations. Like, I can say this now that, like, I don't know that it was made clear to Mike the degree to which Waypoint would be a new thing.
Yeah.
And that wasn't on me. That was on the people who were setting up Waypoint as a new thing. In another world, Mike gets to start Waypoint instead of me, but that wasn't going to happen when it had to happen in New York, because that's how Vice was working at the time. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Vice was like, yep, this has to be a New York-based business. This has to be blah, blah, blah. And I think that that's, I'm grateful for that opportunity, obviously, but like, if I can right one wrong here, it's like to not ignore the foundational work that Mike Diver did. Always hear from Mike. So at the same time, you're right that there was a sort of, here is your blank canvas, go to town, mm-hmm, was sort of offered to me. You're not wrong about that.
And what kind of goals did you set for Waypoint at that point? And like some 5 years later,
yeah,
how many of them do you think you managed to hit?
I would say my eyes are bigger than my stomach. If I could go back now, this is the thing, is if I could go back now and look at the business plans and stuff that I drew up at the time and show them to myself without saying whose they were, I think the me then, looking at them objectively, be like, well, this is never going to work. You're out of your mind. This is so unrealistic in terms of the growth you think you can get with the team size that you have. The thing that happened with Waypoint is we came out with a huge bang. We had this huge 72-hour long stream, and we had people between the audience, just the people that were there then, not even talking about people who would join later, but me, Mike Diver, Danica Herod, Patrick Klepek, and Danielle, in that order, were the forward-facing people at Waypoint. And we all had our own audiences, and we brought those audiences in. And so our overnight numbers were extremely good, because it was like, boom, here we are. Look at this. Like, all these audiences have been activated. And in that way, we were like immediately hit our kind of early goals in terms of how big we were. And we were just putting out content nonstop. You know what I mean? We were doing some absurd amount of pieces per day at that point. It was, I'm now looking at it. Before we launched, when we were vice.com/gaming or vice.com/games, it was 10 to 15 pieces out a week from the US side. When we launched, it was 50 things a week.
Wow.
Global, full staff, US, UK. And that's on top of a podcast, on top of streams.
Those are the articles.
That's articles. Just articles.
Jesus.
We were just like, we're going. Yeah. I mean, Danielle and I were there way too late, day in, mm-hmm, and day out, editing articles. We were in a launch crunch for 4 or 5 months of just like, and we worked our butts off, and I'm very proud of a lot of the stuff that we published at that point. I wish we had not pushed ourselves as hard as we did. And one of the first things we ended up correcting as we went into year two was like, we cannot keep this pace up. It's not getting us anywhere, first of all. The thing that I would say is, like, with that, there are the ideological goals and there are the content strategy and growth goals. Ideological goals was like to leave a mark, to be voicey and young and cool, but connected to real conversations happening in spaces that have been underserved, both in terms of queer audiences, audiences of color, audiences, non-North American audiences, if possible, which is hard because we're a group of North Americans and Mike at the time making this thing. So like, we're going to have those biases. We can't ignore that those biases are there, but to tell those stories, and then also to tell stories about parts of gaming that are not super mainstream in other ways. So like, to tell stories about fandom, like fandom as itself, you know, fan culture, fan fiction, art and everything else, about retro games that aren't getting a lot of mainstream coverage, about fighting games in a way that don't show up in traditional outlets, about little weird, you know, old MMOs that people are still really in love with, etc. And we have some great stories from that era about those things. And we got to work with incredible freelancers who did everything from deep dives into small parts of small communities that they cared about to historical things. You know, some of my favorite things we've ever done are like Duncan Fife's articles on things like the Police Quest series. There's an incredible article that Duncan wrote for us about that. And like stuff like that, I think has been, was like, that is the mission illustrated in front of us. On top of that, also be a personality driven site, because that's what it feels like. That's the way the wind feels like it's blowing in so many ways, that like even big sites are leaning towards or are starting up podcasts and streaming. And how do we develop that side of the business on top of it? And so that was what the goal was. And then Trump gets elected and immediately all that stuff seems both more important and harder. The idea that like we want to be the place you go to for a invested and thoughtful critique about games that is aware of the cultural and political context that they emerge in was critical, was so important, you know, immediately at that point. It was so clear that people wanted that at that point in that era, but also it felt even harder because of how polarized everything was becoming. You know, you can't say the word Trump in an article without it becoming an excuse for people to yell at you on the internet. You know, I reviewed Monster Hunter World and had one brief paragraph connecting it to images that had just come out about one of the Trump sons doing big game hunting. And like, where is my headspace there? What is the connection I can draw between these things? Or why is my brain drawing this connection? Why do I have this anxiety or this feeling of guilt in playing this game that I really love in Monster Hunter World? How does this interact with this other type of hunting that I see? Even that one little paragraph was like an invitation to just ruin my mentions for, you know, which is not, you know, ruining the mentions is much easier to deal with than like literal death threats and everything else, which I've gone through also. It's just like, it's just one of those things that's telling about where the limits of what is acceptable or what will not get you yelled at. You know, where are those limits? And we wanted to push on those limits. Like, I think we ran headfirst into controversy as best as we could, or into, not into controversy so much as like we refuse not to take a position sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, that legacy is very apparent today. I think just a couple of weeks ago, there was a Waypoint Radio episode that opened with a 40-minute conversation about like the inhumanity that the people of Palestine are living through right now.
Yeah.
You had Emmanuel from Motherboard on there, who grew up in Israel and who'd written an amazing piece about the way in which that struggle is somehow modeled in The Last of Us 2, but the perspective of that struggle says a lot about the creator's thoughts on it. And that conversation doesn't feel out of place. Like, even 40 minutes opening in a games podcast does not feel out of place.
I appreciate that.
With Waypoint.
I'm glad that we've managed to find that consistency. In terms of character,
And it's that, and I guess, like, as someone who works in the UK Games Press, which, while you were having that 40-minute conversation, the UK Games Press has largely kept its head down on this subject and others. And even if they did say something, those audiences aren't really developed enough to accept that in any way. And so I can understand why some people
just don't
want to avoid it, but. How did Waypoint get there? How do you get to a point where you can talk for 40 minutes on a subject that important and just not feel like you're overstepping your job? Mm-hmm. Like that's why I listen to Waypoint Radio, because you do take a position. Like, that's hugely important to me. It makes me care more about what you say about games because I know where you stand on that stuff.
Right. I will say it's because you expect us to say it, I think. That encourages us to wade in when we do. It's not a thing we do that often. I mean, it's also a thing we do constantly. Right? It's both of those things. We very rarely go, this is going to be an episode where we're going to spend 40 minutes talking about blank.
Yeah.
But when a game touches something, we're going to talk about it. I would draw a line between two types of conversations. One is, I feel like we need to talk about this because we have developed thoughts about it. What we've gotten away from, done our best to, is the sort of point scoring around a new release or an upcoming release or a trailer looking like it's going to be bad. I remember when Watch Dogs Legion came out, or not came out, but was first advertised a couple of E3s ago. Ubisoft was again stepping in it by saying that their games weren't political. And I made like a tweet thread that was basically like, I'm so bored of this conversation. At this point, what I want to do is to like do the work of criticism, like to let the game come out for me to play it and then for me to talk about what it does. I'm not saying you can't do work on advertising. I think the Far Cry 4, I spoke a lot about Far Cry 4's advertisements when that game was being announced, and the kind of like Orientalism that was involved in it. All that stuff I think is valid, but in terms of directing the full weight of an editorial outlet, I think that we do our best when multiple people have played a thing, because then you have multiple perspectives, or multiple people have read in on a thing. So some things like that conversation around Palestine came after days of all of us being engaged in that. Not just days is wrong. Days of intense engagement, years of learning and talking and listening and all of that stuff. So we were ready to have that conversation in a real way. It was not just like, well, that's problematic. Next trailer, you know. and so I think that's the type of conversation we'd like to have, is one in which we're engaged deeply with a game or with a part of culture, and it comes from us being able to bring to bear whatever our unique perspectives are, and seeing those perspectives collide and shift on each other and shape each other. And the thing is that, like, I think our particular perspectives are so, it's rare that it's like, so we just talked about Biomutant the other day also, for instance. And in the Biomutant conversation, Orientalism comes up, because that's a game that opens up with, I mean, it's a game that has like Wang Fu as a combat style, okay, and like has a bunch of strange East and Southeast Asian, you know, kind of pastiches that don't feel particularly well developed. They feel kind of like weird. And on top of that, everything has this Attenborough-esque narration going on that colors it in a certain way. And it's just an aspect of what we're talking about. But we're not going to not talk about those elements alongside me saying that I think the combat feels kind of floaty and weird. Those are both part of the experience I had playing that game. And so neither of those things is inconsequential to the holistic critique of what is this work. And it's a conversation, and conversations aren't thesis driven. Conversations are bouncy, and you go from point to point, and you try to find an entertaining through line because you're on a podcast, but you also try to like hit everything because you know, or hit as many things as you can think of in some ways, because you know that there's an audience member out there who does want you to weigh in on how you feel about X, Y, or Z if you noticed it. And so I think that is part of why it's just woven in there. It's kind of a flat. Talking about the Orientalism in Biomutant for me is part and parcel with talking about Biomutant as a video game at all. And so we're going to touch on that in the same way that we touch on the crafting or whatever, you know? So I think that's how you get there. And you do that for years, and then you have an audience. And it's a smaller audience than it could be. Like, you're not wrong when you say, like, the audience isn't developed. Developed is, it's tough, because it's like, I never want to be the person who says to someone who's worked a hard week, who comes home and wants to play a game, wants to play Warzone, excuse me, don't you know that Warzone is problematic? And it's like, that person doesn't give a fuck. They don't care. They don't care. Or that's not the way to make them care about the topic, right? The way is through something more careful than that and more structured. And you have to decide that's a project you want to do, is convince the people who come home from a long week of work and just want to like chill on Warzone with their friends, mm-hmm, that they should feel bad about it or something. That if that's your project, then that's a big thing you're gonna have to try to do. In contrast with the sort of like, accept that you're going to have a smaller audience. Do your best to develop a conversation with that audience, develop a rapport with them so that they are also interested in it. But I will say, like, one of the biggest problems with Waypoint in terms of its reach, you know, I've said this before to people internally, that like, I came in very optimistic with the belief that there was an untapped audience for critical games coverage, for the sort of games coverage that Waypoint wanted to make. And there is, but it's kind of small.
Yeah.
When I can point to the best articles that we've ever written, like ever, like the, if you put out our top 10 articles across news, crit, retrospective, you know, profiles, etc., and you, and including very mainstream stuff like the Halo oral history that we did, which is an incredible deep cut, like huge reported piece that started again before my time, even that started during Mike's I almost said reign, but during that period. You take a look at something like that, which had original art and everything else. Or again, you take a look at some of Duncan Fife's articles. Those don't have huge audiences. The very best of the best don't have huge audiences. And that was really disheartening.
Yeah.
For a number of years, realizing that like hitting a home run here barely gets you on base.
So I mentioned it earlier on, but I watched the lecture you gave at NYU Game Center, in which it sort of opens with you admitting that the kind of level of hope you have about games and also games criticism being a positive or kind of significant force when it comes to struggle, it changes day to day. Correct me if I'm wrong on this, but on that particular day, during that particular lecture in early 2018, you didn't have like a ton of optimism on that front. Which something I noticed though is when you were, I asked you about, you know, Waypoint, and you were talking about the things that you're proud of, like Duncan's Police Quest article was one of the first things you mentioned in that lecture in 2018.
Yeah.
That it was almost bittersweet for you because you were talking about the article being great and you could see the reach that it was having, and that made you feel, I don't know, kind of cynical about how much influence this stuff is really going to have. So I guess, has that view changed at all? 3 years on, it's not early 2018 now. A number of things have changed, and including your role at the company.
Yeah. So I in the time since then, I left, right? Like I stepped back. I only do the podcasts now. I'm about to do more podcasts and more streams because we just launched a subscription model called Waypoint Plus, which is fun, and to finally have pulled the trigger on that after years of struggling to get them to let us do that, which I think is telling in and of itself. No, I don't think I'm more positive. I should be clear about, people should go watch that talk I gave.
I'm sure I've
there are things that no. I just think that it
deserves the time.
I'm cynical in a particular way, I think, definitely. In that piece where the reality of what that audience looks, I mean, I don't have to dance around it. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you make an article that is just, here is the new Call of Duty trailer, that's hundreds of thousands of views if you get it up early.
Yeah, quick enough, yeah.
If you get out an article that is about trouble at a BioWare studio, or is about, you know, that style of industry reporting that isn't really about, you know, when I say trouble, I don't mean crunch. I mean a project isn't coming together, to be clear. Yeah. I'm not talking about abuses or anything like that when I say trouble. What I mean there is just like that style of thing. Those articles tend to do really, really well. Hundreds of thousands, millions of views. I think my review of Breath of the Wild, which is one of the biggest games of that year, and I think I wrote a pretty damn good review, 50,000, 60,000, 80,000 maybe views. Over time, that grows. Do you know what I mean? You write a piece about us at the time, you know, when we launched a new Skyrim mod. As long as that piece is not terrible, that thing's going to do huge numbers because Skyrim indexes high on Google and people write good Skyrim mod. And if you've written a headline that is, this is a good Skyrim mod, that's going to do really well, which doesn't, I don't take anything away from the writer of like articles, writers of articles like that. You know, Chris Livingston has written a billion articles about great Skyrim mods over the years and other similar things. And I live and die on Chris's work. Do you know what I mean? But the idea of like, you've no idea how many articles I published that were like, here's why this game means the world to me, because it got me through a tragic death, because it helped me understand my own gender. Here is here is me as a game dev trying to address something. Here is me as a, like those sorts of things. But not even those deep personal things, interesting reportage, No, we're talking about, and again, this is stuff that goes out across the Waypoint audience, but also sometimes the Vice audience more widely. And you just never, you do also just never know when something's going to hit, right? One of our biggest articles of all time was about the MMO Tibia, which is like a game that I don't expect anyone listening would even know what it is. Patrick wrote an article called...
Oh, is it The Secret Door?
The Secret Door. Yeah. That's exactly right. This game, Secret Door, has been a mystery for 12 years. Now it's solved.
It's a great headline, though. It is a great headline.
Totally. Actually, you know what? The first headline is one player's nine-year journey to open a locked secret door, which is even better. This is like a classic.
Yeah.
There's a clickiness to that headline. Mm-hmm. You want to know what's behind the door. You want to know who the player, like all that stuff. There's a mystery, the curiosity quotient and all that. And so like those stories, every now and then something unexpected will hit in that way. Mm-hmm. But looking at those raw numbers was like just deeply disheartening. And again, it's not that we were not successful in our way. It was specifically figuring out what worked and what didn't and finding what how much of an audience is there? Because, what can you do on that success?
Yeah.
Because I saw our freelance budget disappear. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, we got our freelance budget was cut by 76% one year to the next. And that meant the difference between what happens and when that happens. What happens is you go, okay, our freelance budget got cut and our goals stayed the same.
Yeah. Yeah.
And at that point, you go, well, I guess we can't run those articles that don't do any traffic anymore. Or we have to run way less of those. Even though they're hitting an audience, when I say they don't have an audience, I might mean that they have an audience of 20, 30,000 people, but that's nothing for the way the advertisement model works. That doesn't produce anything. No one cares about those. Those don't move the needle. And also many of those, I say 10, 20, 30, some of those are 5, 6, 7,000 people. You know, that's just the way it works.
We have a very similar issue with our stuff. And like we did a piece a little while ago about outsourcing, which
it's an incredible piece. I love that piece.
It felt more important than a lot of the work we've done before. And yet, like, you know, that's sitting on 60,000 views, whereas when we tracked down the Queen's Golden Wii, like that's a million. And like the way Annie and I feel about those two videos is very different. Like, it's not that we're not proud of the Queen's Golden Wii.
Of course.
It's a fun thing, but it's also like, it doesn't mean much to me at all. And like something with YouTube, I guess, is that is slightly different is our numbers are public facing as well, which adds a weird side to that. So like it's when we drop the ball on something, at least audience wise, like people can see it. That feels weird.
People can see it. Yeah. But it's frustrating. It's that same thing. It's a thing of like, I don't care about this piece and it's doing numbers, and I care that it's doing numbers, but I don't want to have my own instincts shaped by the numbers. I want to tell the stories that I think are important to tell and try to use the platform built by the numbers that do the story or the stories that do the numbers in order to bring more eyes onto this one. You know, we were doing wild stuff in the first couple of years of Waypoint. We'd like sent a reporter down to Muir McCammon down to Guantanamo Bay to report on the games and play culture of everything happening in the Guantanamo Bay base, including what prisoners were playing. They're not prisoners, quote unquote. They're detainees, because prisoner, it's a whole fucking thing. This country. And so the stories like that, of course, did nothing. Like, no. We spent a lot of money to make that happen, and those numbers were never going to be big because it was such a niche thing. And also because we were so in our own little shed at Vice for those first few years. We were a small team, one of the smallest at Vice. And we were very, and this is what my boss would tell me over and over again. It's like, you were also very self-sufficient that we never had to get too hands-on with you.
Right.
But that means that when we did a big thing like our, you know, week about the carceral, you know, system and games, that doesn't get a lot of institutional support. That doesn't get huge. We commissioned a ton of art for that. It looked great. We had some really original pieces from just a million different things from people like Yusef Cole. Like, it was a great collection of articles that doesn't get seen. That just like doesn't. No one cares. And so I think when you see that happen over and over again, the cynic in you says, well, none of this matters. What I'll say is you shift. What did happen maybe long term is my the goal shifts, and that's when you kind of find it again. What were you going
to
say?
I was just going to say it's interesting to hear that from your perspective, because from an outside perspective, I remember seeing that week of articles and videos that you ran with the ultimate white man confidence. I emailed you at some point being like, "Hi, if you like, if I could ever work for you guys, that would be great." So from an outside perspective, it clearly meant a lot to the people that did engage with it.
Totally. I think that there is, which is, we slotted into a very particular thing. I'm just in this mode. It's just going to be me and the rest of my life, I think, is the, like, you know, at some point when I was 15, I must have said, I would rather be the Pixies than Nirvana, or I'd rather be, you know what I mean? The classic thing of, like, not everybody listens to the Pixies, but everyone who's listened to the Pixies makes a band, which is also something that's said about like Velvet Underground. But between Waypoint and like Friends at the Table, like that is, we are the podcasters podcast. You know what I mean? Or like that's the much smaller audiences than the widely successful things, but buoyed by things like you emailing me to say, could we work together at some point? Is that a possibility? Did I even say anything nice?
Yeah, you said a nice reply back.
Okay, good. I'm relieved.
I think it was the polite version of like, yeah, we're not looking to expand our video team right now, but yeah. Maybe.
Well, that was because we didn't have a video team. What we had was a room I could go in to talk to the head of video and say, we have this great idea. Can you please give us the budget to shoot this? And be told no over and over again, because what we wanted to shoot was too long or too wasn't clicky enough or wasn't, you know, this was the height of short form video. These stories are supposed to be 3 minutes long, 5 minute videos, you know? And we're out here talking about we want to do a 20-minute mini doc. We want to do... You should have seen the stuff we were pitching and the looks we were getting. Like, I wanted to come out with Waypoint doing 2-hour-long, 1-hour-long Game Crit videos with me writing and do, oh like, that God. Was like, why wouldn't I do that? I am at the height of my strength as a game critic. There's the YouTube market is ready for, like, is doing that already.
Yeah, definitely.
Why shouldn't I be in that conversation? And the answer was like, we don't do videos that long, period. Figure out how to do it in 90 seconds. I was like, God. All right. So, like, it was a different attitude, you know? There's a lot of stuff that we were promised out the gate that just didn't come together. We didn't have a studio for 8 months until after we launched, you know, or something like that. And then what we had was a converted office that got turned into a studio, a converted, like, conference room. It was a lot of working with what we had to try to do as much as we could. And like I said, I'm cynical in the terms of, could this work save us? Or how does this work? What I'm less cynical about now, if there is a way in which I'm less cynical, it's that, like... I've said this before, and it feels self-serving now that Waypoint Plus just launched and we're doing a subscription model thing. But the irony of it all, I think, is you either need a billion people to care about your work a little bit to succeed on the internet, or you need a few thousand people to care about it a lot. And the gap between those two things financially is somehow not that different. It's because the advertising market is a disaster. But like, you know, I'll talk about Friends of the Table because our Friends of the Table Patreon is public, right? Also, because I can just look up those numbers, whereas I actually cannot look up the Waypoint Plus ones because that's just not what my role is there anymore. But if
hey,
I
that's
go
good.
To
like, there's some numbers, it's nice not to see.
Yeah, totally, totally. But like Friends of the Table's Patreon right now has, I want to say 3,800 subscribers, something like that. Patreon is now, of course, going to take forever to load, so I can't confirm this. but it's somewhere in there, near 4,000. That's not a lot of people. It's more people than I ever thought would subscribe to a Actual Play Podcast Patreon, or to my Actual Play Podcast Patreon. But it's not a lot of people. In the sense that, again, if I had released an article that got 4,000 views, it may as well have gotten 0 views according to the advertising model. And so if you can – we live in this world now where I think that is the thing I can advocate for, is for small groups of people to build their affinity networks, to reach their audiences – and develop a closeness to them. Obviously, there are risks involved in this because it's like, one, you're reliant on some third party to collect money and to hope that company doesn't fall apart. Two, there are ways in which only speaking or working with your subscribers can build a bubble around you and limit what you produce because you're so focused on what their particular needs are. But I really think that if you build a healthy relationship with them, they will go with you on a journey and help you to develop the sort of things you want to do. And that to me is super exciting. I talk about this a lot, but the folks at Abnormal Mapping, who do a bunch of incredible podcasts. I'm on the Great Gundam Project right now as a guest. But they have a bunch of podcasts and they are surrounded by other people who are also making great podcasts, right? Things like Novel.New, which look at visual novels and adventure games. There is a billion there's a community of around other communities and around small creators. And to me, that feels like the direction that is, it's, you have to reset your goals. Your goal cannot be, I'm going to change the conversation. It has to be, I'm going to have a good conversation. I'm going to build a space that is comfortable and warm and critical that I get to be in and that helps me pay my bills, but also just like helps me bring joy to some amount of people. You know, I am a huge fan of the stuff I mentioned Cameron Kunzelman earlier, but that Cameron, Danny and Michael do over at Ranged Touch. I'm a big fan of the work that, you know, places like Uppercut, Crit and Bullet Points Monthly. I'm blanking on a big one. This is going to kill me. It's fine. It's fine. It's fine if I don't mention every indie game crit.
He says he's trying to keep the conversation going so he can find it.
I'm not going to find it. I can't believe I'm not. It's fine. My brain is filled. But like those spaces support each other, and you know, it's what is the classic thing about you know, poor queer artists, you know, passing the same $20 bill around. But like, we've managed to get to a place where I think that is much more the space that I'm hopeful about. But again, the hope is just has been
reshaped,
shifted. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The hope is not about changing the space writ large, because that project is a 20-year project.
Yeah.
And I don't have it. I don't have it in me. I don't have it in me for another 20 years to try to be the vanguard of that. 5 years almost killed me, you know?
that was going to be my final question, actually, I guess. Your role having changed at Waypoint, and now you do a bunch of other stuff. You mentioned Friends at the Table. You write comics. You've just started a podcast examining the entirety of the Clone Wars TV series. Is games criticism a sustainable endeavor? Is it something that you could have pursued full time for much longer if you'd wanted to? It sounds like the answer is not the way you were doing it.
The answer is probably not. Well, the thing is, I wasn't just doing game crit anymore, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. I was doing management. I was in 9 a.m. meetings, you know, with mm-hmm. people covering epidemics and really heavy topics. Yep. And I was going, there's a new Mario game coming out. I deserve to be in this 9 a.m. meeting.
I don't think that's fair. I don't think that's fair to you guys.
I mean, I don't think it was fair that I had to be in those meetings at 9 a.m. No, it was really rough to see the extent of our reach, mm-hmm. and to be at the time in a company where reach is what mattered.
Okay.
Because the answer was going to be change what you do.
Mm-hmm.
I worked with a woman named CL for 4 of my 5 years at Vice. CL was my boss. She was the head of editorial. She was like our general. I sat at a desk. I could look to my right and look into her window and see her office. She also had a converted conference room that she just kind of turned into her makeshift office. When I got back from a friend's wedding, I flew back from a friend's wedding in LA and came right to the office because my switch was there.
Right.
I was still off for the remainder of the week. And it was at 10 p.m. at night. I went to the office because my Switch was going to be there on my desk with Breath of the Wild, and I wanted to immediately that night start playing it because I needed to like play it to, one, because I was excited to play it because I knew I was like, I'm ready for this game. Two, because I needed to like beat it early enough to then do a review. She was still there at the office working her ass off. And she's someone who had been at Vice, you know, since she was 22. Working on like the record label Vice had. She was a few years older than me, and was, you know, the closest thing to a picture of myself in the future. And that's a deep compliment to me. It's like deeply selfish of me to say that because of how hyper confident CL was. When she left Vice, it was for a bunch of reasons. One of the reasons was she could feel the layoffs coming and she didn't want to be the hatchet man again. And more broadly, I think it was about, and CL, please yell at me if I'm wrong, it was about being the sort of warm, good person she was, being stuck making the lesser of two evils choices again and again and again, being the shield for people to do the best work they could, but inevitably then also being the shield for a corporation. That was the arc I was on.
Mm-hmm.
There was no other place to go up except deeper into that machine. Why did I quit Giant Bomb? Because I had a lot of hope. Why did I quit Vice? Because, like, I was barely talking to my family because I was working so hard. Because I was working ridiculous hours and then just trying to catch up on sleep debt and just, like, truly feeling disconnected from the world.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I could just... I had to take a step back there. I'm grateful that they worked out a way for me to stay on the podcast. I almost left the podcast totally. And this was around late summer 2019. And my dad actually pushed me really hard on thinking about whether or not I would want to leave the podcast in an election cycle or if I would want to stay tuned in there and hit the audience and have those conversations with that audience. And, you know, at that point, I was like, Dad, the audience is not that big. We are not going to move something, right? But small things happened that made me feel like it was worth it. We've gotten letters from people who are involved in local politics, who run, you know, Planned Parenthood clinics, from people who are engaged in, you know, local DSA parties and stuff like that, from people who are artists and who have told us how much the work means. And when I was able to take a step back and stop trying to, like, hit the metrics that were about optimal growth and just think about how do I make the show good? How do I just make, hey, maybe I'll write a freelance piece. Maybe I'll write a review of Watch Dogs Legion. How do I make this good? How do I make this good and feel content with the, you know, intrinsic joy I get out of making it and the knowledge that I'm reaching some people, even if it's not enough people to keep the whole business afloat, you know? And so with that shifted, I'm optimistic in the lowercase sense, even if I'm not like, this industry's changing for sure. You know, I hope it is. And it has changed. I think maybe that's the actual thing. The actual thing worth saying is we are having this conversation now.
Mm-hmm.
We would not be having this conversation a decade ago. I would not be in this role a decade ago. When I think about what the folks at GameSpot ran after, you know, theirs is still up. The IGN and Game Informer ones are not. Is the IGN one back up in some neutered form?
I don't think it's back up yet. They are currently in discussion.
In talks. I've heard that about the Game Informer one, but...
Right.
Nah, we'll see.
Yeah.
I have some doubts. When I see that stuff happening, a lot of that comes from people like Tamor at GameSpot, Rami, obviously, Rami Ismail from, I guess, formerly of... why have I blanked on that name? On the name of that studio?
Vlambeer.
Yeah, Vlambeer. There have been certain shifts in the industry in terms of who is in what role. The fact that Tamor has an audience and is able to speak, you know, brilliantly to that audience about the situation in Palestine and push his peers to say something reflects a shift in who is allowed to have the microphone. And that is something worth celebrating. It's just also not the be-all, end-all of fixing things, you know? It is a troubling thing, but an important thing to recognize how small our view of the whole is and how totally disengaged with these sorts of conversations the vast majority of people who buy video games are. You think about stuff like the Cyberpunk release, where for months in the lead-up, there are important conversations about the transphobia in that game, about the racism in that game.
Yeah, working conditions.
About obviously about the work conditions. You know, about how where the money would go mm-hmm. to, etc. All of that stuff is a drop in the bucket in terms of what the wider audience even knows about, let alone cares about. You know, I had a kind of my cousin's husband. I was talking on the phone with him recently. He's like, they're both incredible people. They both have law degrees and have decided to just do incredible advocacy work for like deeply involved in justice movement stuff. And he was like, did you play that Cyberpunk? What do you think about that Cyberpunk? And it's like, you are one of the best people I know.
Yeah.
You have no idea. You have mm-hmm. no idea about any of this stuff. Or any of this conversation, like, he's not tuned into that sort of media criticism in that way. You know, I'm sure if I had said, well, think about XYZ, he would have been like, oh, damn, that really sucks. But it just never would have penetrated his field of view, let alone the labor issues, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, which are invisible if you don't know where to go look for them. At least with content, you can be like, yeah, this feels, yikes, this is a little transphobic, this is pretty racist. But when you talk about where these things came from, capitalism has done so much work to obfuscate the ways in which products are produced that you just don't know unless you go looking or unless someone tells you. And so that's the part that can be really tough, is thinking about the ways in which the most important conversations happening in games are really only happening to the very, very tip of an iceberg.
So something you actually said in that lecture, I think maybe in the Q&A, there's value in the fact that if you keep trying to push that conversation, maybe it doesn't happen right now, maybe it can't happen right now, but it's the hope that it does, like, eventually, and that you have laid some of the groundwork for it to happen.
There's like an academic notion. Yeah, there's an academic notion. You know, academics must feel this, or do feel this, mm-hmm. I can say, all the time, which is like, no one cares about this. But you're building a wall, and each thing you do is a brick in the wall. You need all the bricks for there to be a wall. You know, you need them all. Otherwise, there's a hole in your wall. But no one brick is going to be the whole wall. You can't work on building the one wall, the one brick wall. It's never going to hold. And so I think that helps a little bit. And the other thing that can sort of help, there's this double-edged sword, which is we work in a very hierarchical place or space industry where the people up top have outsized power to what they should. It does mean, however, that you can push on those people with influence and see things change here and there. And I don't even mean the CEOs. I mean, you don't need to move that many people for certain conversations to start to change. I don't think this is how you get to, like, class revolution, to be clear. But it is a one way to, like, push people to take allegations of abuse more seriously, or to push people into trying to address, you know, problems of crunch in their company. I hope. I don't know. We'll find out. We'll find out over the next few years of reporting what's up at Rockstar these days, because that's a whole thing. But a funny thing about that the reason that this is on my mind is thinking about that NYU talk. Do you remember the thing I say about GDC in that talk?
Oh, as in,
extremely,
like,
funny.
In terms of direct action, like, why aren't we taking the protests to GDC?
Someone says, like, why aren't we doing that? Yeah. I want to say that was the independent game designer Josie Breckner asked me that. Josie makes Meat Punks, Mixolumia, which is a really cool puzzle game. And Josie asked me that, and I was like, I just don't think it'll happen. Like, I don't think we have the bodies. I don't think we have enough people to buy in on something like that at a PAX, maybe at a GDC, maybe. 6 months later was that disastrous GDC labor talk,
yep,
where Game Workers Unite basically emerges from that meeting. And so it's like one of those things that's a reminder that these things are not made in stone, right? Mm-hmm. Like, when you accept that the world is made of people and the things people make, then the only thing that's between us and a changed world is people changing, right? And so the fact that, like, I it is very fun for me to have been wrong in that way about, and again, not the GWU, not the Game Workers Unite is, like, a silver bullet for for labor issues. It's a very contested organization, and it's a very, you know, it's not a simple thing in any way, and it's not a, in many places it's not a union, you know. But the fact that that conversation kicked off in that exact way was deeply heartening to me and a great reminder of the ways in which things can change unexpectedly and often for the better. So I hope that that continues, and I, you know, I'll keep encouraging it. I just don't want to make it my job to feel like I need to, my encouragement has to get enough hits, you know, to keep food on my table or whatever.
I think that's fair enough. Austin, thank you so much for being on the show.
It was a blast. Thank you so much for having me. Good luck with the entire show and with everything else you do. Genuinely, y'all make incredible work, and you should be very proud of it. I feel like when I saw you go off to make, to do, you know, People Make Games, I remember feeling like this is such a big risk, and I hope that, but the specific thing I hoped was, I hope that Chris is able to make the videos that he wants to make, and that you find enough success to keep doing it, right? It's like the heartbreaking thing for me would have been, you do it for a couple months and go like, yikes,
yeah,
I need to change. Not I have to quit, but I have to start chasing. I have to only start doing, here is the Queen's golden Wii.
Yeah.
And you didn't have to do that, and you've done some incredible work. So thank you so much for having me on. It makes me feel good to be part of that in any tiny way.
That's very kind of you to say.
Thank you so much for listening to this first episode of The Games Press. We'll be back next month, and if you would like to support the show, remember you can find us at patreon.com/peoplemakegames.